through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Joining us right now, it's Michael Bumpus of 710 ESPN Seattle and the Seahawks pre- and post-game show. He's on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Bump, I've now gotten into the habit of just asking you every nice Friday whether you're golfing or not.
You know what? The wife made me take a Friday off.
Okay.
I have folded like 6 loads of laundry today.
Wow. I'm weirdly like impressed. That's a lot of laundry. It's a lot of laundry.
It also makes me wonder, Bump, like, have you used all of your days out? Like, have you used up all of them too soon?
Hold up. So you've got 6 loads of laundry?
Or are we a little bit in the doghouse? Like, what's going on here? Or are we just being a good supportive husband?
I'm trying to be a good supportive husband,
and
this is how you build golf equity here, Jake. This is how you do it.
All right. Well, I'm going to get started by go ahead and right away throwing you a question that I got for the Seahawks Q&A. I have my answer, but I'm really curious about yours because this could go one of any number of directions. So the initial question, Bump, was which Seahawk right now on the roster is floating under the radar and could have a pretty big impact on the season?
Floating under the radar and could have a big impact. You know what? I would say, I don't know if he's floating under the radar, but it's Jordan Brooks, man. I mean,
I would say under the radar.
You know, he's the next guy up. I think last year he played well for a rookie. You see that twitch in him, you know, that people were used to seeing in Bobby and KJ. And I want to remind people, as you get older, you just get smarter, you know, like you find ways to be successful. Jordan Brooks right now, he used his youth to his advantage. You know, he's filling the gaps. He's making the big hits. And I think he has a big upside. So I'm going to go with Jordan Brooks. I expect him to have a really good season this year.
Bump, there was a lot of conversation, obviously, about Julio Jones, and we haven't had a chance to talk to you about it. What's your overall take on the conversation of him being connected potentially here to Seattle? Is it a move that, if everything worked out right, obviously we know the numbers are way too much at this point, but if there was a scenario in which the numbers could work out and you're giving up a second-round pick at the highest, is it something that you could get on board with, or is it something that you believe they've got what they need, they need to steer away from that?
Heck no, I'm on board, man. And I'm surprised that more people aren't on board. I know people are saying, well, there's things you can do with the defense, there's things you can do with the offensive line. I get all that, but when you have a chance to get a player like Julio Jones, you go out and get him. I know you have DK. I know there's Tyler Lockett. I understand Gerald Everett is here now. You have Eskridge as well. But you just don't get opportunities like this. And what does he do to this offense? He makes it that much more explosive. Now, if he can come in and be okay with being a number two guy, because it's really like 2 number ones, and then you have your number two. If he's okay with not having the X routes. You know, your X is your number one guy. You isolate him, you put him in spots to be successful. If he's okay with not being that guy all the time, I say you do it. The more weapons on offense, the better. The defense doesn't have to be a top 10 defense. If they are a middle of the pack type defense, this offense is going to handle it. We know this league is built around the offense, is built for the offense. So what do? It's a race for arms, man. I say you go get Julio, give Russell another weapon.
Now, I am actually more comfortable with the draft capital they'd be giving up than I am with the potential cut or move they'd have to make to create, you know, $8+ million, whatever the difference would be for that $15.3 million they'd have to absorb with Julio's salary. What would you be comfortable sacrificing? Like, whether it's a position group, whether it's a move that you would suggest in lieu of sacrificing something, what would you be comfortable sacrificing to absorb Julio's salary?
Call me crazy, Stace.
I might.
But I am completely committed to doing what the heck the Rams did. I'm like, look, give it up. Give it up. You got a 2-3-year window. Give up some draft picks. Do what you have to do, because I feel like Russ has 2 or 3 more years in his prime. He's going to play forever, but we're talking about like real prime type years. Mm-hmm. Pete's only going to be here for 2 or 3 more years. What do you do? People are so afraid of the rebuild out here. It drives me nuts.
Jake's standing there. Look what you did.
Shout it from the rooftops, Buck. Yeah. What are you waiting for?
Let's go.
What are you waiting for? For the people that are very, you know, nervous, and I'm looking
you
at Stacey Ross.
You guys need to
Ross.
Be more careful. This is why I've never broken
right
a bone. I'm a careful person.
For the conservative people out there, Bump, for people that are just like, I don't know, this will make me feel a little uncomfortable. What are you waiting for? You have the clear window, Bump. What would you be waiting for?
That you don't. It's a gamble. It's not a guaranteed. If it was, hey, you want to give up your 2023rd and fourth first rounders for a Super Bowl? The answer is yes. The Rams haven't won one yet, and they've been doing that.
But the Rams don't have Russell Wilson. The Rams don't have DK Lockett, Chris Carson, Pete Carroll. Bobby Wags is still here. Hopefully KJ's back. Jamal,
sure.
I mean,
this team,
they're built to win right now, right? It was a marathon 7 years ago. We're on like the 20th mile, the 19th mile. You know, it's time to make that move to the front. So I'm like all in, man. All the chips on the table. Let's go get it.
The other thing is that Julio Jones is also, everybody points to, well, you know, he's older. He's at a different point in his career. Exactly. DK Metcalf's still going to be your number one. Tyler Lockett's still going to have his production. And Julio Jones is another player that can add another dimension to this offense. Is it something that I am on the table for, advocating for every single day that you have to do that? No, I still think that they can be successful without Julio Jones, but it's certainly something that I wouldn't be shying away from it whatsoever. I don't think it would be a move that would be detrimental to the team, as some people, as you pointed out, Bump, you know, definitely think. You know, the other thing that it draws my attention to, as we're looking at this offense, we're looking at the defense, you know, at this point, it's been interesting to watch Pete Carroll and John Schneider through this offseason, watch their decisions, watch the way that they've talked and made the hiring process of Shane Waldron. Do you feel like Pete Carroll at this stage has, you know, reflected on the offense and where his team is at and is now okay with this team being more offensive driven?
I think he is, and I think he is because when we talk about teaching an old dog new tricks, right? You typically, like, you know, you can't do that. But Pete Carroll is unique when it comes to that. I think that he has a great pulse on the game and on the players, and I think he knows that, look, all right, 2013-14, we had a dominant defense. That's how you got it done then. That's almost 10 years ago. Like, the game has changed a bit. The rules have changed. This league is built for the offense. So what do? You get more ammo. You know what I mean? You build your arsenal so that when you get into these shootout-type games, which they're going to be in, you can just outscore your opponent and ask your defense for two or three stops. You get two or three stops in a football game, and you have an offense who's able to produce at a high level, you have a chance. So I think he's starting to lean that towards that new NFL, but they're going to have to prove it. Russ has to come out the first week or two to really get him on board. But signing Julio, if they were to sign Julio, I mean, that would cement it. He's definitely on the, all right, let's get into a shootout and blow up the scoreboard.
Okay, so how about this one? Do you think that a hypothetical weapon like Julio, whether it's Julio or whether it's just an explosive offensive weapon or whatever, right? The strength is offense. I think we can all kind of agree that, like, that's where your biggest, most consistent strength is right now. Do you think that that is what is keeping them from a Super Bowl?
That's a great question. I think being healthy towards the end of the year and being able to adapt to what the defense is doing to you, I think that's what has held this team from getting to the Super Bowl. I think that as the season goes along, you get film. Now you got 12 weeks of film. You got 14 weeks of film, 15 weeks of film. So defensive coordinators can pick up on your tendencies and kind of say, all right, they're not adjusting here, so let's force them to do that. And now you throw Julio into the mix. I mean, there's only two safeties out there. You know, there's only two corners out there. Mm-hmm. You got to defend two Megatron-type players, plus a Tyler Lockett and a run game. It's all about making the defense defend every single blade of grass out there, and that's impossible to do. That's what Julio does. It just stresses this defense out. Even if he doesn't run down the field 30 or 40 yards, they're still looking. Where's Julio? Okay, he's there. Where's DK? He's there. Where's Lockett? What do they like to do in this situation? Where's the weakness in this offense? You throw Julio out there, there's no weakness in this offense.
You know, Bump, when you look at the offense, and we talked about this moving forward, the then question goes to, what about the defense? where are we at in that process? And is this defense going to be good enough? You could score as many points as you want, but is the defense going to hold their end of the bargain? We saw last year how hard it is to win shootouts. We saw last year this defense get on track to give up the most yards in NFL history.
Yeah.
Is this defense going to be improved? Because you look at that cornerback spot, and it definitely a question mark.
Yeah, it is a question mark. But you bring in Witherspoon, you're hoping that he challenges for that starting spot. You still got DJ over there. And then you help that defensive line. You lost Jay Reed, but you bring Hyder in. I think Mayo is a guy that isn't talked about enough. He had a good season last year. I think this defense is good enough. They showed last year, like, look, we can tighten some things up. Are we going to be a stellar defense? Going to have the best defense in the league? No. But if you can hold a team to around 20, 21 points with this offense, I think you're going to be in each and every game. I think they have the potential to do that. Now, where I'm waiting to see what happens with KJ. Because, I mean, that's a big part of this defense. KJ, the past few years, had his best years as a pro, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have KJ, who's going to fill that spot? If KJ is re-signed, I feel a lot better. But even if he's not here, I feel like there are pieces out there to make this team, this defense, at least be a little above average.
Bum, tell me what you think about this. I think my assumption about the KJ situation, which we also see a ton of questions about, is they want to get faster on defense, and Jordan Brooks on the weak side, potentially Daryl Taylor or maybe Cody Barton, whoever, on the strong side. You can find someone like a Bruce Irvin type guy that could be a D end or can be a strong side linebacker. That those guys make you faster on defense than KJ would. But if there are injuries or mental lapses where they're like, man, we need a veteran out here, then that's when they would try to make a move for KJ.
Exactly. I mean, there's nothing like experience. You can have all the talent in mm-hmm. the world. You can be young, fresh, ready to go, but you need reps. You need to be in situations, and that's all football is situations. And when you can tap into a part of your brain that says, been here, done that, seen this, okay, let's go play football, that gives you an edge. But then there's also an edge of being a 23-year-old who's got bounce and burners in those legs and can really get after guys. So there's pros and cons for each situation. To be safe, I think you make sure you sign KJ. But if not, man, you throw some youngsters in the fire and see what happens.
Bump, I gotta get in at least one question about your Lakers. Tough stuff. But
yes.
But I know that you were still happy with the run. I mean, what's just the overall feeling right now, man?
Overall feeling is that I was disappointed the way LeBron seemed like he gave up.
Okay, and I was going to ask you, and I was like, how do I phrase this?
That reminded me of, when he walked off the court against the Celtics back in the day when he was with the Cavs. It just shows that LeBron can't do it by himself. When you have a game before where a starter doesn't score any points, I mean, that's cause of concern. It's all about your depth, and the Lakers got exposed last night, the past couple of nights, in the show. Like, look, the Suns, they're deep. The Lakers are not. If Kuz, the number three, isn't scoring 80 points as well, you stand no chance. So, it hurts.
Yeah.
But we're still great. We still got
17 of those things as a franchise, but you're not going to get one this year, unfortunately.
I know where this is going.
Not sad to see it after I saw the way LeBron acted in the playoffs. And my question is, Bump, is who's LeBron going to go after in terms of wanting to trade for? Who's going to be his target?
I know who he should go after.
Well, we all know who he should go after.
Who should he go after?
Dame Dolla, man. Yep. You got to go down to Portland and grab that, man.
Please don't, because I love Damian Lillard. Don't do this to me, Bumpus. don't do it to me.
We have to.
If he wants to win, man, I know he's loyal. I get all that. I respect you for that, Dame, but you need some help. McCollum is not enough.
Can I fit in one more? It's not a weird question. It's just kind of like an on-topic weird question. So if you guys don't follow Bump, you absolutely should. At Michael Bumpus 5, do it right now. Unless you're like driving, then you should pull over safely and do it on Twitter. But you tweeted out, because we've all been talking about this kind of horrible behavior by some fans who are treating players in unacceptable ways, whether spitting on them, throwing things, whatever. I don't care what anyone thinks, it's not acceptable. You put out a poll for people. This is another reason you should follow Bump. You put out a poll and you said, should we put glass around the NBA courts like hockey? And then you had, and the winner was no glass. I gotta ask, as our last question here, where you stand.
It was kind of, I would say if this continues, you have to do something. And another guy was like, man, it's too close to the court. I'm not talking about like literally right on the court. I mean, like maybe a few rows up, you throw the glass up there. If people can't behave, you got to put them on punishment, man. And one guy can ruin it for everybody. Something has to be done. And what I want to see done, other than the glass, if that's a possibility, is that expose these dudes. Like, I'm tired of them hiding their faces. Like, nah, shame them. Let's shame these dudes, because they're going to be the ones who ruin it for everybody else. I don't know. Maybe the glass, maybe not. Just expose these cats, man. They're ruining the game for everybody else.
Well said. He is Michael Bumpus, joins us every Friday at noon. Thanks, Bump. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
All right, this hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. It is 12:15, kind of. That means it's time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
With Jake and Stacey.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down to you, Jake. What will Will Dissly do? What did Will Dissly do this offseason to get better?
Well, go to cut number three. Will has been all over the place, but got some interesting insight from guys that he's been around this offseason.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the league for, you know, 3 years now, all in there, shot timer. Those guys have experience in different offensive coordinators, so they're getting to run, you know, a lot of different offenses. And with Shane coming in and installing some of his new plays, I was really excited to see some new dudes pop up and ask them, you know, hey, how do you run this? What do you see against defenses? And, you know, those guys are all so smart and can kind of verbalize it. So that was a cool thing, just talking through those, running those routes, kind of working on different ways to create space. You know, tight ends, we're not all super fast, but we're crafty, and we figure out a way to get open.
So Will Dissly did something a little bit different this offseason, was healthy, changed the scenery, went to Nashville in the offseason, went to a facility out there to work out and get better. And there was a bunch of tight ends out there, pro tight ends, TJ Hawkinson, former first-round pick with the Detroit Lions, Robert Tonyan, who had a fantastic year with the Packers, even George Kittle was out there training at this facility, and just really being able to pick their brains and really able to learn and talk through the game with those guys can really be a benefit, and you can pick up different little things in terms of the way you run routes, the way you approach the game. And Dissly has looked fantastic, been able to see him a few times down in San Diego with Russell Wilson, and he's in the best shape I've seen him since his rookie year. So very excited for Will and the preparation that he's done this past offseason to put himself in the best position to be successful for this team and for him personally. So very, very cool to look at the process and to see how he changed up his routine and how it's been very positive for him.
Second down. All right, Stacey.
DJ.
What is your level of comfort with Seattle's current defensive backs?
In an ideal world, I will say this. They are the most untested position group on that defense. And I say that knowing that KJ Wright might not be back here and that maybe Cody Barton may not be your Sam. So you've got essentially two outside linebacker spots. One is going to be a relatively new player and someone else is going to be first time filling in there. That said, the most untested position group is going to be corner. In an ideal world, I would like to see them add to that. I would like to see a veteran brought in. It's primarily because of three things. One, their struggles in the first half of last season. Two, inconsistent play and availability from the potential starters in that group. And three, just the reality of facing a tough division. So I think that right now, Pete Carroll seems very comfortable with it. He's been asked about, on many occasions, Richard Sherman coming back. He's also been asked about KJ Wright, obviously. He seemed to indicate that with the cornerback group and with the team as a whole, he's fine with it for right now. And he's going to wait, this team is going to wait to bring back any veterans or to make any more moves until they see what they have with this group, whether it's in mandatory minicamp, whether it's into training camp. And I would guess that they probably expect that Sherman and Wright may still be available so they can kind of hold off on that decision. That said, it's not that this group can't be solid. In fact, this group could even be good, right? Like, I don't want to undersell them. I just want to make it clear that I do have a little bit of kind of caution tape that I'm not going to be surprised if I'm not going to be surprised if analysts paint them as a liability, at least in the beginning of the season. They're going to have a lot of questions to answer. If you are someone swayed by confidence, you're going to love this group. You're going to love guys like Witherspoon saying, when I was healthy, I was the best corner in the league. That's an awesome mindset to have. I don't know if it's true. Awesome mindset to have. Trey Brown, a confident guy that's going to get out there. DJ Reed was phenomenal last year. I don't want to undersell what he did. It was just those 8 games were his career high in starts. So you've got a lot of untested guys, but plenty of potential. But that is my answer, to be fair.
Third down. All right, so you guys asked Bump this question about a little over 20 minutes ago. You guys asked him which player is flying under the radar on the Seahawks roster the most. And Bump gave his answer, and his answer was linebacker Jordan Brooks. So, Jake, I ask you the same question. Which player on the Seahawks roster is flying the most under the radar?
The player that I would say that's flying under the radar the most has to be Daryl Taylor. Like, to me, he's the player that stands out to me the most. And the reason why is he doesn't come front of mind because he didn't play last year, right? I mean, how can you think of that person right away when they didn't contribute last year? But this is a player that, as we have highlighted again and again and again, they considered him with their first pick. Instead of taking Jordan Brooks, they were really considering taking Daryl Taylor. They value his talent that much. To me, he's a player that, under the radar, if he can come out and show and display that talent in his rookie year, basically, I'm going to say that this is his rookie year, even though he's going into year 2.
Fair.
If he can display that talent, I will feel very confident about this defense because they are going to use him in a hybrid role. Strong side linebacker. They're going to use him at rushing the passer. I really, truly believe that he'll take over that Bruce Irvin role that they've had in the past. And I think that he could potentially be a perfect fit for that defense in that particular position. So Daryl Taylor is the one that stands out to me, but I do agree with Bump that Jordan Brooks, and he's one of the players that I said, one of the 3 young players that has to step up on defense in order for this unit to be good. There's also a lot to be said about Jordan Brooks taking that next step.
Fourth down. All right, super quick fourth down here, Jake. What percent chance would you give for the return of KJ Wright in Seattle, and what might prompt that return?
Percentage, I'm going to say that it's 30%.
Wow, that's more than I would have given it.
I'm going to say 30%. Reason why is because, as I mentioned, Daryl Taylor, somebody that's flying under the radar, still an unproven commodity. And if he's not able to come out in training camp and in the preseason games and show that he can be trusted in that role, if KJ Wright is still available through training camp, don't be surprised if the team pulls that trigger and says, no, we can't play around with this. This year is too important for us to give Daryl Taylor the leeway that we didn't even give Marquise Blair in his rookie season, right? So I think that going with a known commodity versus talent and upside is the way that the Seahawks are going to approach this thing heading into 2021. But they're going to give Daryl Taylor every single opportunity to prove that he's ready for the show. And KJ Wright is in a really weird, unique spot where I don't know if he gets signed before training camp. This is a guy who's played at a high level, high character guy. It's very shocking to see him still available on the market. But as I've said before, he now plays a specialty role. If KJ Wright was of a couple years ago and he's playing Will side linebacker still, I think he's off the board already. But because he's made that transition to Sam linebacker, that's a limited role. That's not an every down role. That's a first, second down role. And I think people are, our teams are way more patient to sign a guy like that than ever before.
Johnny Manziel is in hot water after what he said this morning. But I got to tell you, I'm not mad at it. And I don't think many of you will be either. I'll tell you what it is next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline on Jake and Stacey, telling you everything you're going to see on your own timelines today. What are you going to see trend in? What are you going to see people talking about? Well, a big part of that is going to be because of an article from Sports Illustrated circulating the Twitterverse earlier this morning about the league potentially not cracking down enough on the use of foreign substances for pitchers. So this from ESPN just a little bit ago. It's from Jesse Rogers, who says that according to sources, MLB umpires are going to crack down on pitchers using illegal substances on baseballs. Now, as a note, we did earlier, at the start of the season, as did many of our other shows here on 710, talk about the league's goal this year to just kind of make sure, right? It was, you know how every year NFL will have like our point of emphasis. Our point of emphasis this year is offensive holding. Our point of emphasis is going to be defensive pass interference, whatever. MLB this year was going to have a point of emphasis. They're focusing on foreign substances. According to Jesse Rogers of ESPN, after repeated efforts by MLB to dissuade pitchers from using illegal substances, the league is going to crack down by giving umpires more latitude. So what they've done is over the past 2 months, the league has been collecting a random sampling of baseballs, shipping them to a lab, a third-party lab. And they're not going to use the data to punish anyone retroactively. So if they've been collecting a bunch of baseballs and they found that, like, the Orioles... collections from the Orioles, which wouldn't be the case, but let's be real, are using foreign substances a lot with their pitching staff, they're not going to go back and punish them, but they are going to use that data, give it to umpires, and try to empower them to have a bit more knowledge of how often it's being used.
To me, it still blows my mind that this is something that is going on in baseball right now. It's obvious. I mean, so obvious that our own Curtis Rogers, at a kid from Kent, tweeted this back on May 5th, M should really have looked at John Means' glove. No one has ever tapped the ball into their glove that many times between pitches without something being up. Now,
I didn't say it.
A month ago, we had our own Curtis Rogers looking at this and wondering, something doesn't seem right here. And this is something that we know has been going on, but obviously has gotten to an extreme level that this is being brought up, and that now you're having umpires trying to crack down on this.
Yeah.
I mean, why is Major League Baseball so slow to react? As Graz said to us earlier on the show today, it doesn't make any sense. You are the caretakers of your product. Mm-hmm. And when you are seeing the batting average dip to a level that is has never been seen before, you're just okay just sitting back and letting it ride?
I think that MLB is both incentivized and de-incentivized to allow this to happen. What I mean by that is you look at like the steroid era and let's say this era where whether the use of foreign substances is up or not, pitchers are just better than they ever were before. So you've got two kind of separate eras there. And I know we can talk about the year of the pitcher and all that, but let's just stay here. When guys were demolishing baseballs, it was kind of good for baseball. Like, it wasn't right. I get it. Don't do that. But plenty of people were watching. Plenty of people were tuning in and talking about it. And just how much of a monster these guys were. Baseball cracks down, rightfully so. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's bad for baseball, but also gets eyes on it.
Mm-hmm.
Pitchers are just throwing nasty stuff now. Like, they are just elite now. In a way, that's good for baseball. But it's also been horrible for offense. The strikeup rate is higher than it's ever been, or strikeout rate is higher than it's ever been. Average is lower than it was last year, and I think one of the lowest that it's been in a while. I know it was 234 for a while. I don't know if it's below that now or not. Pretty much everything offensively is down. That's not good for baseball. So it's kind of at odds with itself.
You're allowing more advantage to go to pitchers that already have the leg up on hitters. And that's why you're seeing this drastic change, right? We already know that the approach that pitchers are taking to their game is better than what the hitters are already doing in terms of launch angles and not really valuing the hit as much as they are home runs, walks, and don't really care about strikeouts. You add that on top of the fact that you've got pitchers that are doctoring the ball so that their stuff is even that much better. It lends itself to this issue that we're seeing right now. And if you're a caretaker of this game, Stacey, if you really truly care about this game, how do you let this product continue to go on? And right now they're reacting to it. They're reacting slowly to it. But there's so many other things that they could do to baseball, just naturally in terms of the way that they can tweak the game to make it more fun, to make it more entertaining, to bring the value, the entertainment value back to the sport. It's just hard when you see stuff like this in baseball where you hear these universal ways of trying to cheat the game, and it's just like, oh, well, it's okay. It's all right for an extended period of time, and then out of nowhere, oh, now it's gotten to the point where we need to address it. Well, it's been going on for a while, so Why hasn't it been addressed before? It's just one of those things in baseball that's always just really confused me.
All right, last story here. Johnny Manziel said that he made, quote, a decent living selling autographs at Texas A&M, but then also adds he never took a dollar before winning the Heisman. So this was on an interview with a Barstool Sports podcast. He said that two transactions got him $33,000. This is how he talks about one of them. So essentially in one of them, he signed thousands of pieces. He got $3,000 for it. And then someone else said, oh, this guy's ripping you off. Let me tell you what, I can pay you even more. So he tells him, go to this room at this, I don't know what this thing is, like a club or a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Go to this room at this place. I'm going to have a bunch of merchandise in there. And when you're done signing it, just send me a picture and then I'm going to send you the money. And he did it. And he got presumably like $30,000.
Yeah, I'm sure Johnny Football was only accepting money after the Heisman. I'm sure he didn't accept any other benefits or any other cash. I have a hard time believing that. And I love that it just coincidentally happens. Like as soon as he wins the Heisman, everything was just totally kosher. Like everything that we know about Johnny Football and his brand and everything else, that he wasn't taking advantage of the system that was there in front of him.
But I'm not mad at that.
I'm not mad at it necessarily in the sense that, look, you have a likeness that you can profit off
of,
but you know the rules. This is highly illegal.
It is.
It's highly illegal. It doesn't matter, Stacey, whether you agree
that
he should be making money off of it.
The bylaws themselves are dumb.
Sure, but everybody's abiding by those laws.
They are not.
You are blatantly.
Schools are violating these laws. Not autographing, but schools are violating these laws.
When you go past the point of you are willingly and obviously cheating, you are taking money that you know that you should not be taking. I don't care whether it's you know, the conversation of whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent in terms of the NCAA cracking down on these things for the amount of years that they've had. You know that it's illegal, and you know that you're putting your university in jeopardy. You know that you're putting your Heisman in jeopardy. That's why I'm shocked that Johnny Football is coming out and saying this now, because the NCAA could go back and retroactively take away wins. They could go back and take away his Heisman.
The best part is that was his answer to when he said, but it wasn't before the Heisman. So they were like, are you worried they're going to come back in and punish you or take away the Heisman? And he's like, oh, I only did this before the Heisman.
They absolutely I wouldn't be surprised if they investigate
this.
No,
backwards or something like that.
If they come back after Reggie Bush and take away his Heisman, why wouldn't they take away Johnny Football's Heisman? Why wouldn't you do that?
Now you're swaying me here. I got a break here. We got to jump into another conversation. We're going to have Dave Sims joining us in 15 minutes to talk about the Mariners. We have plenty of questions to ask him. Coming up next, Jake and I disagreeing a bit here. We have another disagreement, but I think two pretty solid arguments, and it's a fun conversation. Which NFC West quarterback is under the most pressure? Jake and I disagree over whether it's Russell Wilson. We'll tell you why next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
All right, Dave Sims is going to be joining us in about 15 minutes. Before we get to that, though, we have a conversation that we're going to have. I'm going to say it, not a full-blown debate or anything. It's just I was surprised, Jake, that we disagreed on this,
Debate.
Genuinely surprised. This hour of Jake and Stacey, by the way, brought to you by the Pro Club. He is Jake Heaps. I'm Stacey Ross. I asked you guys which NFC West quarterback is under the most pressure this year. It's a conversation that's been happening all over our airwaves. And so I was thinking about it the other day and just told myself, well, of course it's Russell Wilson. Like, why wouldn't it be Russell Wilson? And I thought it was so interesting because I thought you could make a case for any of the other quarterbacks, but it feels like the obvious answer is Russell. You disagreed.
I did, because in terms of job security, I think that these other teams and what's at stake for these other teams is more significant than it is for the Seahawks. I mean, let's go down the list. The Rams, they traded two first-round picks for Matt Stafford.
True.
They put themselves in an incredible bind financially to get Matt Stafford. This is a move that isn't deemed successful unless they win a Super Bowl. Like, that's the type of move that you made with Matt Stafford. The others, you look at Kyler Murray, if they're not successful this year, then guess what? You're looking at Cliff Kingsbury potentially being on the hot seat and no longer being the head coach in Arizona this next season. You go with the 49ers, Jimmy G is fighting for his life. You got Trey Lance that also, he, you know, the 49ers took an exceptional risk in terms of trading up for him with their third overall pick. That's a move that instantly puts Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch on the hot seat if it doesn't work. That's a boom or bust move. So there is a lot at stake for those other three quarterbacks' situations to succeed. And I'm not saying there's not pressure on the Seahawks or Russell Wilson, right, and there's not a lot at stake, but look, Russell Wilson's contract isn't running up anytime soon. Neither is Pete Carroll, neither is management. Like, they're in a situation where it's a lot more stable here in Seattle. But if you want to turn this in a different direction in terms of the national narrative,
yes,
into narratives,
I sure do,
then yeah, there's a lot of pressure on Russell Wilson.
Yeah, but Russell Wilson started the conversation. Russell Wilson, in my mind, part of the reason that he is under the most pressure this year is, A, the bar is higher for him than anyone else. It's the reason that he's one of the only guys here not playing for his job. Kyler isn't playing for his job. I don't know that Stafford is per se, but they've just got less to stand on there. Jimmy G certainly is. Russell isn't playing for his job. But in coming out and pointing to someone else, even though it was relatively benign, and I don't know that he meant to point at the offensive lineman so much as pointing to a problem, you have fingers pointing back at you. And I think for the first time I can think of, I'm going to see regular texts from listeners saying Russell Wilson took 3 of the 5 sacks in last week's game. Russell Wilson was accountable for this many sacks. Like, he is going to be, people are going to be being like, he held on to the ball for this long. Those are always conversations we have, right? They're things that matter in the game, but I think a much larger number of people are going to be doing it. I also think while the other guys have pressure on them in terms of immediate results, immediate job security, Russell Wilson has pressure mounting in terms of legacy. Russell Wilson doesn't just want to be the best quarterback in the NFC West, which I think he is right now. He wants to be better than Tom Brady. Russell Wilson wants to be the best to ever do it. Every year you're running out of time. Every year you don't get to a Super Bowl is another year that you haven't gotten closer to that. I mean, inch closer, but you're not taking big leaps and bounds.
Mm-hmm.
That's pressure. There's pressure on legacy, less so pressure on the result week to week. Although I do think that Russell Wilson's comments, as part of a larger narrative, you know, in and outside of Seattle, does put the spotlight on him.
Now, I do agree that there'll be a section of Seahawks fans that will be loud in terms of their criticism of him each and every single week if the performance isn't strong. If you know, you talk about the sacks, looking at that through a microscope, I'm not going to be too worried about that. Ultimately, I think it's going to be a conversation that, did it get brought on by himself? Yes. Are people going to more focus on that? Yes, absolutely. But it's still not going to change the way that I evaluate the quarterback position or evaluate whether Russell Wilson's being successful or not. I think it's just something that people are going to look at. But in terms of what really catches my attention, Stacey, is you talk about legacy, you talk about national narrative. That, to me, I fully agree with. Because if you look at the end of 2019, the national narrative was that Russell Wilson has arrived. Russell Wilson is at the forefront of the conversation of not just being one of the top quarterbacks, he arguably the best quarterback. It's him and Patrick Mahomes in that 2019 offseason heading into 2020. I mean, we're NFL top 100 players. You know, I don't take that necessarily with the
It was a conversation that was happening.
But he was rated higher than Patrick Mahomes in that ranking. Like, there was a legitimate narrative being set that in the quarterback hierarchy, Russell Wilson is ready to take that mantle as the best quarterback in the league. 2020, the first 8 weeks, it looks like he is about to take off and cement that narrative. And then we all know what happened in the second half. It really crumbled down. He's got a lot to prove in that aspect in terms of the national narrative, in terms of reestablishing himself towards the upper echelon of the quarterback hierarchy and reestablishing himself there. Everybody knows he's a top five quarterback, but is he arguably the best quarterback in the league. I think that that's what he has to reestablish himself as, is not just for 8 weeks of the season, but the entire season.
All right, Mariners heading into June. Plenty of questions, whether it's about Jared Kelnick. Lots of excitement about some other guys like J.P. Crawford. We are going to throw all of those at Dave Sims, who joins us next. Do not go anywhere.